your parents well. Their children's hell will slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they fix, the one you know by.
Hello, my friends who listen to futureprimitive.org. I am extremely happy this morning to be speaking on the phone with Rick Doblin. Rick Doblin is the president and founder of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, known as MAPS. He co-founded Earth Metabolic Design Laboratories in 1984 to support psychedelic research and Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies in 1986, with the goal of making MDMA, also known as ecstasy, an FDA-approved medicine. He subsequently obtained a psychology degree from New College in Florida in 1987 and earned a doctorate in public policy from Kennedy School of Government, Harvard University, in 2001. Doblin also served on the board of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws since 1996. I will tell you some of the writings of Rick Doblin. One of it is Regulation of the Medical Use of Psychedelics and Marijuana. And the other one is written by Doblin, Richard, and Kleinman, and Marx, and it's called Marijuana as Anti-Emetic Medicine, a Survey of Oncologist Experiences and Attitudes. But I'd rather jump in immediately in this privilege of being with Rick Doblin. Rick, I've been thinking about an opening question for you, and actually it's a matter of gratitude, because when Dr. Timothy Leary was in prison, I studied his work very, very deeply in order to assist him in freeing himself. And what I noticed in studying his work is that his great sorrow, his great sadness, his great trauma was that as a psychologist at Harvard, he felt so deeply that psychedelics should be handed over to the medical profession for medical use. And his heart was broken when these things were criminalized. And so you are doing the work of pointing out the medical uses of these substances.
Well, I actually feel like I come in contact with the ghost of Timothy Leary a lot, because, you know, much of my work, I live about 1 mile away from McLean Hospital, which is part of Harvard Medical School.
Wow.
And it's where more psychiatric research is done than anywhere else in the world. And it's also the place where we've been able to start psychedelic research up again at Harvard for the first time since 1966, when Walter Pahnke, who was Tim's student for and did the Good Friday experiment for his dissertation, he stayed on after Tim was kicked out in 63. Walter stayed around doing some research with psilocybin until 1966, and we've struggled, but we've been able to restart psychedelic research at Harvard again. And they're very cautious, and they constantly talk about Tim, and they're very concerned about every aspect of publicity, how the study is treated in the media. They have all sorts of concerns that I think are excessive about safety. But nevertheless, they do see potential, the people at McLean Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been able to do a study with MDMA for cancer patients with anxiety. So far, one person has been treated, and there's two more that have been enrolled and will hopefully be treated in August. It's a study with 12 people. And then there's also been research on the use of LSD and psilocybin for cluster headaches.
Right.
And what the doctor at Harvard has discovered, John Helbert, with Dr. Torsten Tassi in Germany, is that they have basically discovered the cure for cluster headaches. And it's actually bromo-LSD.
Aha. Uh-huh. What does that mean, Rick?
Well, it means it's not psychedelic.
Uh-huh.
So that LSD and psilocybin help to cure cluster headaches. It's just amazing. It'll break a cycle. People's cycles can last for weeks or months.
Yeah.
And they take three doses of LSD or psilocybin every 5 days. So day one, day five, day ten.
Uh-huh.
And it doesn't even need to be that high of a dose.
Right.
100 micrograms or so of LSD, you know, 10 or so milligrams of psilocybin, and the cycle of cluster headaches is gone. What they've discovered is that bromo-LSD, which is a slightly modified molecule of LSD, which at those doses does not have a psychedelic effect, it seems to work better even than the LSD and the psilocybin.
Well, isn't that poetic justice, since Albert Hofmann was looking for a cure for headaches?
It is, and the circulatory system. What we actually started the study with bromo thinking that it wouldn't work.
Mm-hmm.
We thought if we can show that the part of the LSD molecule that affects cluster headache is linked to the part of the molecule that produces the psychedelic effects.
Yes.
Then we would say, people at McLean Hospital, that we needed to go forward with LSD research. And so we thought, we might as well try bromo-LSD, and then when it doesn't work, we'll be in a better position.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turned out, to our surprise, bromo-LSD worked.
Extraordinary.
And then with the cluster headache people, what we've had to say, and this is, I think, the key point, one of the key points, is that when we talk about the medical use of these drugs,
mm-hmm.
it has to be about what's best for the patients.
Yes.
So that even though our goal is to try to reintroduce psychedelics into medicine and psychiatry and into our culture, that because bromo-LSD is not psychedelic and it works better for cluster headaches, we've been advising the cluster headache group called Cluster Busters
yes.
to forget their research with psilocybin and LSD and just move straight into bromo.
Extreme.
Because that's what's best for them. And that will also free us up to get back to what we're really interested in, which is psychedelic psychotherapy and psychedelic spirituality and what the implications are of that.
Sure, yeah.
So we're right now talking with Cluster Busters about whether they're ready really to give up the psilocybin and start working with the bromo, or, you know, how, so they're thinking about that. But what's so exciting is that little by little, I feel like, you know, the ghost of Tim is no longer haunting, or not haunting as much, the
yes.
administrators and the psychiatrists and psychologists at Harvard.
Yes, yes.
And symbolically, that's where I felt like, to show that our culture had really turned a corner and was ready to start taking a fair and unbiased look at psychedelics again,
yeah.
that
yeah.
we would need to do two things. One of them was start psychedelic research at Harvard.
Yes, yes.
And the other was to start psychedelic research with LSD.
Mm-hmm.
Because LSD is the most demonized, the most
exactly
identified with psychedelics of all the psychedelic drugs. And we've been able to start a study in Switzerland with LSD for people with anxiety associated with end-of-life issues. And Albert was able to, and Anita were both alive when the study got approved.
Yes, yes.
They could see that it was returning to the scientific laboratories.
Beautiful. Yep.
Yeah, that was very satisfying. For a while, that was our top priority, was trying to get the Swiss LSD study up and running while Albert and Anita were still alive to see it.
That's beautiful. Absolutely. Well, what I got in my shower this morning was exactly that. That was a crucial moment for Timothy when he realized that it wouldn't be given to the medical profession. And that's what created a lot of the behavior that's paradoxical, because it gave a bad name to LSD.
Yeah. You know, I've done a lot of research following up on Tim's studies that he did at Harvard with the Good Friday experiment and the Concord Prison experiment.
Exactly.
And, you know, I feel I was fortunate enough to spend some time with him. And actually, I brought two prisoners who were in the Concord Prison experiment to visit with him a couple weeks before he died.
Wow.
It was very nice. One of the prisoners had been able to stay out of jail, and one of the other prisoners, the other person who I brought, had gone back to jail, even though he'd had the psilocybin experiences.
But what a gift, Rick. What a gift you brought to Timothy.
It was beautiful.
Yes.
Yeah, the one thing that I should say, though, is that I think Tim got a little bit caught up in all of the oppression that was being put on him, and all of the propaganda that was being put on psychedelics.
Oh, definitely.
And he tried to fight back in some ways that were good and some ways that were not so good.
Horrible.
Yeah, so I think, you know, with the Concord Prison experiment, he ended up saying that it was successful, even though it wasn't.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, he realized early on that you can help somebody have a transformative experience with a psychedelic drug, but whether that produces behavior change depends on aftercare, on integration, on how people take the opening that they've gotten through their psychedelic experience and how they put it into practice.
Right.
So with the prisoners, he realized that once you help them have these important experiences with psilocybin, and then they're let out of prison, that they needed a support group, a halfway house, kind of like AA in some ways for alcoholics, that they needed mutual peer support. And he tried to create that, actually. But then he got kicked out of Harvard, and it fell apart, and the people didn't have the support that they needed, and they ended up going back to jail at the same rate that the people who didn't get psilocybin.
Exactly.
And so I think Tim felt that there was so much propaganda that was untrue about the dangers of LSD that he sort of went the other direction and created some propaganda about the benefits of psilocybin. With the Good Friday experiment, that was tremendous, and that is actually what inspired many people currently working.
Excuse me to interrupt you, Rick, but could you summarize the Good Friday experiment for some of our younger listeners?
Realize, but there was a time when psychedelics were not controversial, and that they were in all of the scientific labs. There was an enormous excitement about their potential, and there was this recognition that psychedelics in plant forms had been used for thousands of years by different cultures who had encased them in religious rituals, and that they were associated with deeply powerful spiritual experiences, like peyote with the Native American church, the use of mushrooms.
Yes.
That goes back thousands of years. And there was a lot of discussion about whether psychedelics really could catalyze a genuine religious, spiritual, mystical experience, or whether it was a delusion, or whether it was all just hype. Mm-hmm. And so Tim worked with Walter Pankey. This is in 1962.
Yes.
And to give a sense as to how non-controversial these things were at the time, they approached a man who was the mentor for Dr. Martin Luther King.
Wow.
Howard Thurman.
Yes.
And he was the chaplain at Boston University when Martin Luther King was getting his PhD there.
Wow.
And he was very excited about the writings of Aldous Huxley and others, and he said to Tim and to Walter that he would permit them to bring a group of 20 divinity students to the basement chapel at Marsh Chapel on Good Friday mm-hmm. in 1962.
Yes.
When he was leading a service, and that this service, which was around 3.5 hours long, that he would permit them to be in the chapel, in this basement chapel, and half, they'd all get a pill before the service. Half was going to be psilocybin, strong dose, 30 milligrams.
Uh-huh.
And the other half was going to be nicotinic acid, which was designed to fool the people into thinking they got something. It produces a hot flush, skin turns red a little bit. It acts quicker than psilocybin, but then it goes away after mm-hmm. about an hour or so, and there's really not that much in the way of psychological effects. And so the Good Friday experiment was designed in a phenomenal way. Mm-hmm. Walt Stanky spent about a year or more before the experiment took place reading the literature all over the world from different religions about what the mystical experience was. And he extracted the core common elements.
Mm-hmm.
And he worked with W.T. Stace, who also was a scholar of religion. And they developed a questionnaire, which they called the Peak Experience Profile.
Mm-hmm.
And it was designed to measure the depth of a mystical experience without any cultural references. So there was no, did you see the image of Christ, or did you see Buddha, or did you see Moses, or...
Yep.
They just took away all the cultural references, but stripped them down to sort of the core emotional experiences and intellectual experiences, and developed this questionnaire. And then the goal was that after these people, the 20 divinity students, had gone through the service, they would then fill out this questionnaire, and then they would be contacted again after 6 months to look for long-term effects. Because in the mystical literature,
yes,
what often used to determine if an experience is genuine or not is called the fruits test. It's like the fruit of the tree.
Uh-huh.
What does it produce?
Yes.
And that's basically what I was saying before about how with the Concord Prison experiments, mm-hmm. you can have a powerful experience, but it's what does it produce in your life? How do you support and nurture it? So exactly. The fruits test is really this long-term impact of a mystical experience. And it was defined as something that helps people to transcend time and space, to be in the presence of something sacred, to feel that there's a unifying force,
yes,
between connecting everything, the sense of paradoxicality and ineffability that you can't express it in words. And
mm-hmm.
so the Good Friday experiment, through these questionnaires, showed that 9 out of the 20 people had above the cutoff score for a mystical experience.
Yes.
And then when they uncovered the blind, 8 out of those 9 had the psilocybin.
Wow. Yep.
Unfortunately, Walter Penke died in a scuba diving accident in 1971.
Mm-hmm.
And, I was convinced that that he would have done a long-term follow-up. But in the middle 80s, when I was looking to do a senior thesis at New College of Florida, where I was a student.
Right.
Everybody has to do a senior thesis. And I wanted to do something with psychedelic research, but in the middle 80s, it was impossible to get permission to actually administer a psychedelic to a human being. And so what I realized is that this fruits test was the key. If I could find the people from the Good Friday experiment 25 years later,
wow,
in the middle of the Nancy Reagan just say no escalation of the war on drugs.
Uh-huh.
And ask them, did they think it was genuine? And did they have other mystical experiences without drugs that they could compare it to?
Mm-hmm.
And then also, what were the impacts on their lives? That if there was any kind of a cultural bias, it would be to discourage them from saying that they had gotten anything beneficial from it.
Yes.
And I was able to travel the country and identify 19 out of the 20 of the people who were in the study. All the records were lost. Walter had not kept any records of who the names were. Tim's files didn't have it. Nobody knew. And they were at Andover Newton Theological Seminary. And so all I knew is that people from that school in 1962 participated in the experiment.
Mm-hmm.
To show you how the society turned, in the 80s, when I went to Andover Newton, This is a seminary school.
Yes.
And I went to their library. They did not even have a copy of Walter Pankey's dissertation or any of the papers that had been written about their students in what was and still is the most rigorous, scientifically designed study of people taking a psychedelic drug in a religious context.
Amazing.
Searching. So they tried to completely blot it out, but I was able, through finding some alumni address books in the library there, to just send out mass mails to everybody who was in school at the time. And I ended up finding 19 out of 20. And basically what happened is that the people who had been in the psilocybin group invariably had some very powerful memories about some parts of the experiment and their experience in the chapel. It's like if you ask them, what movie did you see, you know, 25 years before, they wouldn't be able to tell you. But something about psychedelics and the brain and the emotions imprints very powerfully, and this can be both good and bad.
Yes.
But the people who had this mystical experience remembered parts of it very strongly. And I saw something that, you know, Tim is often blamed for causing this counter backlash.
Yes, yes.
Because, you know, he would talk about the value of psychedelics, and then people would be unprepared, and they would take it, and they would have problems. And so I think there's some truth to that. But basically, I think that it's not because of what he did. It's, in fact, well, in a way, it is because of what he did, but it's when psychedelics go right.
Yes.
That there can be problems as well. And what these people who were in divinity school, many of whom were still ministers, what they said is that the core element of the mystical experience, the sense of unity, and also this confrontation with death,
yes,
they were able to feel more empowered. They weren't so scared of dying. Mm-hmm. They were focused on the present moment, the life that we do have.
Yes.
And because of this unit of experience, they were more willing to see common ground with people who were different than they were to try to get scared of them. So that they got very involved, some of these people got very involved in the civil rights movement, the women's rights movement, the environmental movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement. And so they attributed the inspiration and the power and the loss of the fear, some of the fear of death, to their participating in the social struggles of the day. And that's how I mean that we had a lot of the problems of the 60s when psychedelics went right, because our culture was so rigid. And also I think there was this fundamental problem, and this is what we're very much focused on now. The lessons for me of the 60s is this self-identification and sort of forced identification as a counterculture.
Yes.
So that people with interest in psychedelics are kind of pushed out into the margins. They're not part of the mainstream. You can't be part of the mainstream if you find that your life has developed, you know, a lifelong positive, beneficial relationship with psychedelic drugs.
Exactly.
You're somehow scorned it. And I think that that's something that has a romantic appeal, too, that we're part of this counterculture, this advanced wave. We're going to go off on some island and, you know, create our own utopia.
Yeah.
But I think what we've learned over the last 40 years is there is no private utopia. You know, global warming, nuclear weapons, environmental destruction, all these things are global. There is nowhere to go to escape.
Exactly.
Well, MAPS is an IRS-approved 501c3 nonprofit organization, research and educational organization, and basically we're a nonprofit psychedelic and medical marijuana pharmaceutical company. And we're not chartered to change the laws.
Right.
Now, that doesn't mean that we can't speak out. And in fact, nonprofit organizations can lobby with up to 20% of their resources. So we don't actually lobby. But the whole idea of the Rite of Passage project is to try to go after and clarify one of the biggest drivers of the drug war, perhaps the biggest driver of the drug war, which is the fear that's been placed in parents about the problems that will come to their kids if they ever use a drug.
Exactly.
And so the Rite of Passage Project is really to say that our culture is historically an anomaly, and that most cultures have had some sort of rite of passage for the children that was powerful and really did help them in this transition to adulthood.
Exactly.
And that many of our religious rituals don't have that power anymore. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I often, whenever I want to kind of get my parents upset a little bit, I tell them that what really led to my doing LSD was my bar mitzvah.
Elaborate on that.
Well, my bar mitzvah did not turn me into a man.
Right.
And I thought it would.
Uh-huh.
You know, I was the oldest of four children, and I really didn't know any better. And so I thought that this rite of passage that had been going on for thousands of years, you know, as I was sort of getting into the awkward adolescence.
Right.
That somehow I thought this ritual is really going to change me
mm-hmm.
in some way and give me courage, give me confidence, give me a better sense of who I am, give me some sort of spiritual connection.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I believed all of that, and then it didn't happen.
Right.
And it left me recognizing that rites of passage have to be really in tune to people's inner lives and inner struggles, and that it sometimes is the case that rites of passage from a prior culture or a prior age
yes.
don't always continue to work. And for me, when I finally took LSD, one of the thoughts I had, my very first trip was, this is what my bar mitzvah was supposed to be.
Wow.
You know, it's engaging me at this sort of deep psychic transformation level.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a test of courage. It's like an ordeal. It's, you know, it is this transition. And I was not prepared for it and had a lot of troubles because I really didn't have the emotional skills to let out emotions.
Yes, yes.
So it was, you know, very problematic for me, very difficult, but I did feel that this sort of inner transformation mm-hmm. that was supposed to be taking place at my bar mitzvah mm-hmm. was in fact taking place in a kind of awkward, unstructured, and not so much of an adult-led context from my psychedelic experiences.
Mm-hmm.
So where we are as an organization is that we're free to speak out just about, you know, issues of the day.
Yes.
We don't really lobby, even our work on medical marijuana. I mean, we are very much working with Congress and working with the U.S. Senate in our effort to break the federal monopoly on the supply of marijuana that can be used in research. And that's the fundamental reason why we have all of these state medical marijuana laws.
Yes.
Is that, you know, it's a diversion of social energy. Marijuana should be evaluated as a medicine like all the other medicines are through scientific research.
Absolutely.
But because of the monopoly that the federal government has on the supply of marijuana, they won't, you really can't get it if you want to look at what's good with marijuana and you want to make it into a medicine. So we lobby in a different sense of the word. There's a regulation. We sued the DEA. We won an administrative law judge hearing that said that it would be in the public interest for us to get for Professor Lyle Craker to get the license
uh-huh.
to grow marijuana. And then we go and try to get members of Congress and senators to write to DEA or the Department of Justice and say, you know, this argument made sense. You know, you guys should really force the DEA to give the license. That's not lobbying because we're not trying to change a law.
Mm-hmm.
We're just trying to get the DEA to follow a judge's recommendation. So the Rites of Passage Project is something that's completely legitimate of a thing for MAPS as a 501c3 to discuss and to work on.
Excuse me, Rick, is somebody serving tea in your office or something?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, there was a little noise. I was doing that. I'm
sorry. Okay.
I was actually trying to put away the dishes. I was trying to do it quietly.
Well, the recorder is very sensitive.
Well, you know what they say, you know, before enlightenment, chop wood and carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood and carry water. I just got the dishes.
Perfect, perfect, of course. Please continue.
the Rite of Passage Project is really just an effort to kind of focus people's attention on, is prohibition the best way to protect our children?
Mm-hmm.
And are there better alternatives for some children, according to what their parents actually want?
Okay.
And to the choice of the parents, and have that be a family matter rather than a government matter.
Well, this is supremely important.
Yeah.
Rick Doblin, we are going to bring our talk around, and I'm very happy to announce to our listeners that you have agreed to do a second part to this interview, which we will do at the end of July. And this is especially wonderful because MAPS has just put out the last edition, the most recent edition of their journal. And this is of great interest to Future Primitive because it's a special edition on psychedelics and ecology. And there are many authors, which I will not begin to name because I don't want to leave any out, who have written beautiful pieces for this journal. So the special edition is edited by David J. Brown, M.A. And so we will meet again.
Yes, sir, and I look forward to being with you and your listeners.
Oh, thank you.
In a couple weeks. I very much enjoy speaking.
Thank you, thank you. And if you permit me, I would just like to ask you a last question because it's a question from my heart.
Sure.
And that question is that when I was at the birthday of Albert Hofmann in Basel, the 100th birthday, there were many people who were in prison for manufacturing LSD or being caught with LSD, who wrote the most poignant and beautiful letters to Albert Hofmann, thanking him for his discovery of LSD. Could you comment on this amazing paradox that people could be in prison and yet be grateful for the experience?
Yes. Because of TV and the media and the drug war, this idea of the noble drug dealer has really gone out of fashion. You talk about drug dealers and, people have all sorts of negative connotations. And in the 60s in particular, and 70s, there was a real understanding about how certain substances, the psychedelics and marijuana in particular, could be dramatically, fundamentally beneficial to people.
Mm-hmm.
And millions of people have these experiences courtesy of illegal drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that all people who are working to provide these illegal drugs are motivated only by money and are cutthroat and will use violence to do whatever ends they want to achieve, rob, steal, that will adulterate their drugs, that model fits the LSD dealers the least.
Mm-hmm.
That the LSD dealers often did have a noble purpose and a mission in their own minds, that
yes,
they were providing tools for consciousness expansion.
Right.
To a world that desperately needed it. And that the forces of the culture were aligned against the distribution of these substances.
Yes.
And that people who were risking their lives, their freedom, to provide these substances and these experiences to people, many of them did so out of noble motives.
Yes.
And at some great risk, and without usually making a whole lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that this sentiment about people who had been crushed by the prohibition machine and were having years of their lives taken away in jail, you know, many of them still felt that they had gained so much. I mean, I feel that I have gained so much from my psychedelic experiences that my work is a way to pay it back.
Wow.
So I think that these people who were writing to Albert to express their gratitude, even though they had run afoul of the law and were in prison, were acknowledging that LSD and the psychedelics were distributed for different reasons, different motives, by many, many people, and that they were proud of what they were doing, and it took courage, and many of them have suffered the consequences. Now, it's also possible, look, there's all these people that you might have the most noble motives, but you sell 50,000 hits of LSD, and somebody's going to flip out, and somebody's going to have a psychotic break, and somebody else is going to answer that.
Sure, sure.
And there are these risks, but I think that what we get down to, and this is what Tim was so good about, was the individual's freedom of choice.
Yes.
That our government is trying to stamp out people's freedom of choice to have certain kind of experiences, certain kind of consciousness, in the interest of supposedly greater social good. And often those are based on flawed risk-benefit assessments, and people fundamentally need to make these choices for themselves, but we do need a society that's supportive of these choices and that recognizes that people are going to encounter difficult experiences. Not only can you not avoid it, but you don't want to avoid it.
Exactly.
And one of the principles that we say in our work with psychedelic emergencies is that difficult is not the same as bad.
Yeah.
And that, you know, if you're predisposed to think of something as you get into a stuck spot or, you know, powerful negative emotions come and you think, oh my God, you know, this is bad and I'm going to spiral down into this, you know, horrible psychedelic experience, that you're sort of programming yourself to go in that way. And if you can recognize, hey, this is hard, but this is really turning over the mulch, you know, this is stuff coming up. And it's something that if you work with it, you can get become deeper as a person. So that
same as in everyday life.
Very, very much.
Yeah.
And so I think that there's this sense that people are responsible. People do make choices. They are responsible to some extent to what happens to them. We don't have a society that supports experimentation in this way. We've done some work at festivals where, you know, the festivals think nothing of having a medical tent in case somebody gets hurt, but trying to get a tent for people who've had difficult psychedelic experiences to get help is a struggle. And I think the festivals of the future in a post-prohibition world will have these sort of services.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's very satisfying to provide them to people, to see people come in really, really scared, and then in a relatively short time sort of work on issues that may have been bothering them for much of their lives.
That's right.
So I think that, you know, to get back to this question about people in jail who, you know, are still grateful to the discoverer of the drug that led them on the path that brought them into prison.
Yes.
That they're in prison physically, but spiritually they're out of prison. And that's a deeper kind of a freedom.
Yes, yes. As Timothy said, love cannot be imprisoned.
Yes, exactly, right.
Well, fantastic. I look forward also to when we will meet again in a couple of weeks to talk about psychedelics and ecology.
Yes, that will be wonderful.
Okay, Rick.
Okay, bye, Joanna. Bye all your listeners.
Okay.
Sorry for doing the dishes.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm glad you do the dishes. Okay.
With my wife, that's for sure.
Yeah, exactly. Well, all women are glad that you do the dishes. All right.
Okay.
Next time.
Sure. Bye, Sarah.